Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Adria Breyer, a member of the club's Health and Medicine member-led forum and the chair of today's program. It's my pleasure to extend a special welcome to any new club members who are here. We know you'll enjoy your membership and we hope you'll come often. The H&M Committee, the Health and Medicine Committee, is in a very privileged position. We welcome our members commenting to us what they would like to hear, and we're able to design various programs for whatever is current in the world. My particular focus as an international consultant in cancer and having had multiple cancer episodes has been to support the committee and seek their support in my choices of bringing people in who are medically, professionally recognized, but also speak outside the traditional paradigm to give hope to people that they're not, that their passing is not a foregone conclusion. Dr. Lipton was gracious enough to show up as part of that, and I can't wait to hear what he has to say. We have two additional programs coming up. There are many others you can find on our website, commonwealthclub.org, and you can also register on the club's 24-hour hotline. On January 11th, we have Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel, Transforming Healthcare Post the Affordable Care Act. On January 17th, Suzanne O'Sullivan is providing a neurologist's compassionate look into the misunderstood world of psychosomatic disorders, and she's going to do that with case histories. I invite you to check our website again. In approximately March, the club should be moving to its new home at 110 Embarcadero, so I urge you the next times you come to always double-check and make sure the location is the location you're planning to drive to. You have question cards on your chairs. We'll be recording today's program. And now I'm going to begin to introduce Dr. Lipton. As many of us know, we grow up thinking doctors are gods and that what they say is the final word. They don't know what they don't know, and we don't know what we don't know. So imagine being a doctor amongst all those doctors internationally, where your download has been that 1 and 1 equals 2, and realizing that 1 and 1 doesn't always equal 2. There's a different way. And Dr. Lipton did that for all of us. His views and his research showed that we are not products of our genetics, that we can change through lifestyle. And he faced the ridicule of his colleagues and fought his way to reach what his colleagues now see as a deemed professional and probably one of the few in his field, and he continues to be the cutting edge. Generations have to be grateful for his work, not just in the present, but the children and the families, because every time someone gets a disease label, a diagnosis, cancer, diabetes, Alzheimer's, it doesn't matter what it is. It used to be that that was it. You were out of control of your life. And when you're out of control, you get depressed and you generally go downhill. With epigenetics, that doesn't happen. You have control back of your life. You have an opportunity to live. And your children, if there's a genetic predisposition, don't have to have what they thought was going to be the problems of the generations past. Bruce Lipton, cell biologist and lecturer, is an internationally recognized leader in the new biology. He did pioneering research on cloned stem cells in the 70s and early 80s. Now, most of us are hearing about stem cells now. Can you imagine 35 years ago, Dr. Lipton's working on stem cells? Who is this man? As a fellow in pathology at Stanford University, 1987 to 1992, his groundbreaking published research on cloned human cells revealed how perception controls behavior and gene activity. All of this work presaged the revolutionary field of epigenetics, the new science of how environment and perceptions control our genes. This is science. He's the best-selling author of The Biology of Belief, the updated 10th anniversary edition, which is going to be sold afterwards, and he's happy to sign. He's also the best-selling author of The Honeymoon Effect and co-author with Stephen Behrman of Spontaneous Evolution. In 2009, Bruce received the prestigious Gyo Peace Award in Japan in honor of his scientific contribution to humanity and world harmony. And here's what they across the world said about Bruce. They recognize that his work empowers the public to take control of their own lives as he bridges science and spirit. There are many cultures, including Ayurveda, Asian, acupuncture, Chinese medicine, who know that spirit is a great part of our health and our lives. Traditional Western medicine is having a really tough time grasping that. Dr. Lipton, with his credentials, is helping to bring that forward. His current research investigating the biochemical pathways connecting the mind and body provide insight into the molecular basis of consciousness and human evolution. For more information, visit brucelipton.com. I also encourage you to sign up there to be abreast of what his work is. It is now my great pleasure, with great gratitude, to introduce you, Bruce, to your audience.
Thank you so much. Thank you. All right. I'd like to thank every one of you for coming out tonight, and I really hope that you get to hear what I'm trying to talk about within an hour and 5 or so minutes, because it's so relatively important to understanding how powerful you really are, because we've been programmed to believe that we are frail, vulnerable creatures, and the fact is that's completely false. We are so powerful, of course you can walk across hot coals, as long as you believe you can walk across hot coals. And there are so many different aspects of the belief nature. And then you're talking about, well, what's belief? And I go, well, listen, if you've ever heard of the placebo effect, then first of all, you've heard about how belief is controlling biology. And then it turns out it's not a small part of your life. It is the major part of your life, and I want to explain it. And so basically, I'll go very quickly, but with enough information to allow you to see where this is going to go. And I'll start off with this understanding, and that was in 1953. I remember the day that this was announced to the public. I lived in New York. We used to get the Daily News, which was like a rag. But it always had a big picture on the front page, so I would always go out in the morning and open it up and see, it was always some gangster getting shot or some kind of weird thing going on. And this one particular day, I go out on the porch, open up the newspaper, there's not a picture on the front page at all, which was like, and in big block print from the top to the bottom of the front page, it said, "Secret of Life Discovered." And it was the story of the DNA double helix. The DNA double helix, I want to straighten this story out just a little bit right now, and that is this. We always credit Watson and Crick for this, but I really would like to straighten this out. The primary person involved was Rosalind Franklin. A woman did this. And it's really important because the old boys club was not interested in that, and her major advisor actually gave her research without her even knowing about it and gave it to Watson and Crick, and from her research they evolved this. So I'd like to honor and thank Rosalind Franklin for her brilliance in putting all this together. I say, what's the relevance about this? And the idea is once you start to get the understanding of DNA as the programmer of our lives, we start to recognize that we get DNA at the moment of conception, and that DNA appears to program the rest of our lives. So we're somewhat predetermined by the genes that we get. 5 years after the DNA helix was understood, Francis Crick came up with an idea, and it's called, this is the actual name, the central dogma. And the central dogma, I have it like the Ten Commandments because it has been the equivalent of the Ten Commandments for conventional biology for, it was almost 50 years. And the relevance about it is this. It is the flow of information in biology. And as you can see, it starts with DNA, goes to RNA, which is like a Xerox copy of the gene. And then the RNA is the blueprint to make the protein. You are the protein. We're the protein machines, okay? Most importantly, the information, according to the central dogma, only flows in one direction. You say, well, so what does that mean? And I go, you're the protein. Can you go back and change your heredity? And the answer is absolutely no. So that was a conventional belief. Your genes control you, and you have no control over the genes. And this is what is the emphasis of the central dogma. The relevance about this, which is interesting to me, is because I taught it for a number of years in medical school and never really looked up the definition of dogma until I got out of medical school. And I looked it up, and the definition of dogma is a belief based on religious persuasion and not scientific fact. I was teaching religion in medical school for a number of years. And the simple reality is that we bought into this belief that genes control your life and you don't control the genes, which automatically makes you a victim, you know, and this is the whole issue that we have to talk about. So when it comes down as this Life magazine, were you born that way? Well, at first we thought it was just the physical characteristics, but they started to find, no, genes are associated with behavioral characteristics. Genes are associated with emotional characteristics. And all of a sudden it's like, oh my God, all the characteristics of a human were apparently pre-programmed in the genes. It's a concept called genetic determinism. And this is what I was teaching in medical school. The significance about that is since you can't control the genes and the genes control your life, what does that make you? As I said, well, what it makes you is a victim. You're a victim of your heredity. You got cancer running your family. You say, oh my God, I'm going to get this cancer. I got Alzheimer's. I'm going to get the Alzheimer's. The point about this is once you believe you're a victim, by definition, you have been disempowered. Because if you're a victim, I says, I can't control this. And the problem is, once you find that you're disempowered, we naturally seek somebody or something to help us. We seek a rescuer. And this is where the pharmaceutical industry came in. And the relevance about that is we give up our life and say, oh, give me the drug. The drug is going to fix me. And it's like, unfortunately, over 300,000 people die every year from pharmaceutical drugs. Which is interesting because we have a war on drugs. Of course, that's against the illegal drugs. And the current statistic is 13,000 people died from illegal drugs, 300,000 people died from pharmaceutical drugs. I think the war's misplaced a little bit on this, okay? So the relevance about this is this victims because we bought into this belief. Genes, you heard turn on and turn off. A gene activated itself or inactivated itself. And therefore, since we give genes the character of a control that they behave on their own, genes turning on and off, it's not up to us, then when we find where the genes are in the cell, they're in a nucleus. And the nucleus of the cell is the biggest organelle in the cell, and it's the repository for about 98% of the DNA. And I say, well, what does science consider this? And I say, well, here's from the National Institute of Health, a handbook for the public, and it says the nucleus is the cell's brain. I say, where'd you come up with that? And the answer was, well, since DNA controls the patterns and expression, and since DNA apparently turns itself on and off, then all the action was coming from the nucleus. And therefore, we bought into the belief that the nucleus is controlling your biology because that's where the genes are. That's the belief, okay? And so the relevance about that is, well, if nucleus controls the function of the cell, then the nucleus is equal to the cell's brain, then here's an important fact. If you take any living organism and you remove the brain from an organism, I say, what would be the consequence of taking the brain out of an organism and throwing it away? And the answer is very simple. The answer is the organism dies. And I say, why is it relevant? Because I say, well, what if I go to a cell and I remove the nucleus, which is supposed to be the brain of the cell? It's a process called enucleation, and I actually was doing enucleation studies back in 1965, and here's a surprising result. What happens if you take the genes out of the cell and throw a nucleus away? And the answer is this. The cell lives and its behavior is unaffected. A cell can live for months with no genes in it. And it's not just sitting there. It's carrying out all complex forms of life, respiration, digestion, moving around, recognizing what's in the environment. It's doing everything with no genes in it. Well, the relevance is very clear. The nucleus is not the brain of the cell. That's very clear. You might say, well, then what is a nucleus? Well, science is a male-dominated profession. The nucleus is the gonad of the cell. And since males apparently think with the gonad, then making the nucleus the brain seemed to make sense in that world. But the reality is, no, it's a gonad. It's reproduction. That's all it is to reproduce the parts of the cell or reproduce the whole cell. So the nucleus is not the intelligence of the cell. So here's a fact. Genes do not control biology. Why? Let's just start off with the very first fact. Genes are not self-actualizing. Point? Genes cannot turn themselves on and off. Genes have no control over their own expression. Genes have no intelligence in the sense that they know what they're doing. Genes are blueprints. They are exactly blueprints. They're nothing more than a blueprint. This is very important because I say, well, why? I say, well, look, you go into an architect's office. She's working on a blueprint. And you ask her, you say, is your blueprint on or off? And she'll look at you like, well, you're crazy. It's a blueprint. There's no on and off. And I go, precisely. Genes are blueprints, but do not control themselves. The genes are controlled by the environment and our perception of the environment. And this is very important because since you can change your environment and since you can change your perception, then you're not a victim of your genes. You're the master of that control. But I'm going to explain how it works, okay? So I say, what did I get into this? And I say, well, back in 1967, 40, that's a long time ago. It's almost 50 years. Oh, my God, that's a good celebration. 50-year anniversary of my research on stem cells. I was in the right place at the right time. I worked with a man who was one of the first people to clone cells, and I was cloning stem cells back in 67. What does cloning a stem cell mean? Well, what is a stem cell? Let me give you that right away. A stem cell is an embryonic cell. Same exact thing. You say, well, why don't I call it an embryonic cell? And the answer is, a moment before you're born, if I did a biopsy before you were born and I showed you a tissue biopsy, I say, look, oh, here's an embryonic cell. And everybody goes, yeah. And I say, wait, 1 minute after you're born, I do the same biopsy, show you the exact same cell. And it's like, oh, now it's called a stem cell. Point, once you're born, I can't call it embryonic cell anymore. So just to make it easy, a stem cell is an embryonic cell. It's a multipotential cell. And what did I do? I'd isolate one stem cell, put it in a dish all by itself, and it divides every 10 or 12 hours. So I start with one cell, then there's 2, 4, 8, 16, doubling. Point, 1 week of cells in culture, guess what? 50,000 cells in the Petri dish. Most important point, they're all genetically identical. Why? They came from the same parent. I have 50,000 genetically identical cells. That's not the experiment. Here's the experiment. I take the cells out of this culture dish here and put them into 3 different culture dishes. And here's what I change. You ready? The culture medium. You say, what's the culture medium? It's the environment in which the cells live. So if I'm going to put cells in a culture dish, first I put culture medium in, then I add the cells. I say, well, what does culture medium represent? Blood. If I want to make culture medium, I go to the organism I get the cells from, look at the composition of the blood, and then try to make synthetic blood. Culture medium, synthetic blood. So if I grow mouse cells, I look at mouse blood composition and then create a culture medium based on that. Or human cells, I look at human blood composition, same thing. Why is it relevant? Culture medium is the equivalent of blood. I go, well, what's significant about my experiment? Since I synthesize culture medium, I can change some of the components. I'm synthesizing it. I could add a little of this or take a little of this out. I can change it. So here's what I have. 50,000 genetically identical cells. I split them up into 3 dishes, but I change the culture medium ever so slightly in each dish. So in dish A, environment A, culture medium A, my stem cells form muscle. I change the culture medium composition in environment B. In environment B, the stem cells form bone. I go, wait, go back, get some more genetically identical cells, put them in environment C, and they form fat cells. Well, this is back at a time when genetic determinism, what I'm teaching in a school, genes control life. And then I come in the laboratory and I go, it's not true. What controls life? You already can see what controls life. They were all genetically identical. The genes did not make the decision of what they were to become. It was the culture medium composition. The cells were adjusting their genetics to the environment. Change the environment and you change the genetic expression of the cells. Okay, so it wasn't an inherent control from genes. Genes did not make this decision. It is only the result of environment. Well, that was back in 1967 when I started. The new science that I saw and was describing since 1967 actually became an official science in 1990. It's called epigenetics. You go, sounds like genetics. I go, it's a revolution. It's a change the world. Do you mean what? Genetics is the belief of genetic control, which simply means what? Control by genes. Oh, cancer is under genetic control. Alzheimer's is under genetic control. The belief that genes were making these things, okay? Epigenetics is a revolution. It says, but it almost sounds the same, epigenetic control. I go, epi means above. What do you call skin in Latin? Epidermis. Why? It's above the layer called dermis, above the dermis. Epigenetics, epigenetic control means control above the genes. And this is the revolution. Genes have no control, and yet we all grew up with the belief that genes are determining and causing things. There's a big mistake. The two words that are problematic is this. The two words that get confused are causation versus correlation. Causation means the action of creating. Correlation means something associated with. Yes, there are cancer genes. They don't cause cancer. They're correlated with cancer. The cause is not the gene. There is no gene that causes cancer. That's a fact of life. Okay? Genes are correlated with cancer. That means, why is it relevant? Angelina Jolie has a double mastectomy because her mother died and her grandmother died, and they said, oh, well, you know, her family with physicians, you got to go have this mastectomy to prevent the cancer. Problem. Only 50% of the women with the breast cancer gene, the BRCA1 gene, ever get the cancer. Problem? Nobody talks about the 50% of the women with the gene that never get the cancer. What was the point? They have the gene, they don't get the cancer. So the gene is not the connection to the cancer. A gene is correlated with it, but never caused the cancer. And that's the big issue we have to understand. Epigenetics, above the genes. The control is above the genes. So I say, well, how does life work? So I can tell you so simply, so we don't have to do 4 years of science. 2 minutes. Goes like this. A cell is made out of proteins. There are over 100,000 different proteins. They're different. Each protein is a different part. It's like a giant Lego kit. I have all these 100,000 proteins. What can I do? Well, I assemble these and I make a muscle cell. But I can assemble some of these proteins and make a nerve cell. Or I can assemble some of these proteins and make a skin cell. So you start with 100,000 different proteins, and how you assemble them creates the different tissues and cells of the body. Okay? So the proteins are the parts that create the system. Okay? And once you understand that the proteins are the parts that create the system, then we're ready for what we're ready for, secret of life. I love the secret of life because it's so damn simple. Here's the secret of life. Proteins, 100,000 different ones, each with a unique shape, each with a unique structure. I say, what else do they do? Well, they provide for the structure. I go, yeah, the human body is a protein machine. And I say, but proteins alone don't provide for life. You know why? A cadaver is still a protein machine, but it doesn't work anymore. So there's proteins, but no life. Where's the life come from? And here's where it is. Proteins respond to environmental signals, information in the field. And when a signal shows up that complements a specific protein from the environment, what happens to the protein? It changes shape. Holy geez, what does that mean? Movement. Proteins are the molecules that move and change shape in response to the environment. I go, why is that relevant? Because biology is harnessing the movement to create life. Respiration, digestion, excretion, muscle contraction are all the action of proteins changing shape. A cadaver has all the proteins, but they don't change shape anymore. So what do you think is missing in the cadaver? The signal. The signals. All of a sudden, proteins are there, but there's no more signals to control them. Nothing moves anymore. Still got a cadaver with proteins, but no life in this point, okay? So you say, well, how does it work? I said, here's an interesting protein. It's called kinesin. And kinesin, when it walks on this structure called the microtubule, that's the signal. When the kinesin touches the microtubule, it changes shape, okay? So watch this. Here's the protein. It's walking. It's changing shape. The left side of the protein and the right are alternating as it touches the signal on the microtubule. And at the other end of kinesin, it's carrying a vesicle across the cell. So the protein is like a miniature person, if you think about it. It has a job. It holds on, walks down the microtubule carrying this behind. You go, well, proteins can do all these things. I go, look, to understand how proteins work, I'm going to use something that makes the Bay Area for me so exciting. It's a video from the Tesla company. I love the Tesla company. I say, why is it neat? Here's the manufacturing plant, okay? The red machines are assembly units. What's unique about them? Each red machine is the equivalent of a protein. You activate it, it has a very specific movement, and then just has that movement over and over again. I say, yeah, but what can you do if the proteins are moving? I go, this is a macro scale object of what's happening. It's building a car. Where are the people? They're not in there. It's a machine driven by these red things, which are the equivalent of proteins, each doing a specific movement. When you line them up in a sequence, it's an assembly line. Take this at the nano level, and the proteins in your body right now are building you. Not a car. They're building your cells. They're making all the actions, all the movements. So there's nothing different in regard to the function of these proteins, or these machines, versus the function of proteins. They do exactly the same thing. They have behavior, they move, they integrate and work together. So here's the conclusion. It's so simple. You're a protein machine, but proteins respond to environmental signals. I say, how do they respond? When a signal binds to a protein, it causes the protein to change shape. The changing of shape is harnessed. The movement is harnessed by the cell to carry out functions. So the movement of proteins is behavior. So your biology inside of you is a whole bunch of protein machines being driven by signals to carry out the functions of your biology. Okay? Well, significance about that is I say, how does it work? Well, in my culture, I put the cells in the culture, I add the signals. When I add the signals, here's the interesting part. The environmental signals attach to the skin of the cell. The skin of the cell then relays the signals inside the cell. Okay? I say, well, what does that mean? I say, what happens, I just repeat this again, what happens when a protein responds to an environmental signal? What does the protein do? Moves, engages. So what does it mean? Environmental signals show up on the skin. The skin then relays those signals in, activates behavior. What's behavior? The movement of proteins. Okay? It activates behavior. And I also then say, well, wait, I don't have all the proteins that I may need. If a signal shows up and I don't have the responding protein, does that mean I don't do anything? And the answer is no. If the signal shows up and the protein is not present, guess what? The signal goes into the nucleus and activates the gene, the reading of the gene, to make the protein. So the activation of the gene wasn't by itself. The activation of the gene was the environmental signal. Well, this is the whole new edge of science in the last 10 or 15 years because the new science is called signal transduction. Not looking at the genes and doing that. The new science is what environmental signals are influencing what function inside the cell and tracing the behavior. So we're trying to undo, take apart the system by looking at this. Signal transduction is the whole thing, but a part of signal transduction is when the signal goes into the nucleus and activates the gene. That's where the epigenetics comes from. Epigenetics is how the environmental signal controls genetic activity. And you go, wow, these are cells and they're so weird looking compared to people. And I go, we are the same as cells. Cells are miniature people. There's not one new function in your body that's not present in almost every cell in your body. Virtually every cell in your body has a respiratory, digestive, excretory, a nervous system, an endocrine system, a reproductive system. Cells even have an immune system. Point. A human expresses behavior, but the behavior a human expresses is a character of a cell. The cells express these. It's just a community of cells that constitutes your body. So the relevance about this is interesting because it says, where's the nervous system? The skin. The skin is picking up the signals and then actually controlling what's going on inside the cell. And you go, well, you know what's interesting? If you understand human embryology, where do you think the nervous system came from? The skin. The skin on the back of the embryo becomes the spinal cord in the brain and the nervous system. So we and the cells are so similar to each other. That's the beautiful part about why you can get information about humans by studying cells. So the brain of the cell is the membrane, okay? You say, well, how does it work? I go, well, look, here's how it works genetically. So let me show you epigenetics, the mechanism. You ready? It works like this. Inside the nucleus, you open it up, there are 46 chromosomes, 23 from your mother, 23 from your father. I say, what the heck is a chromosome? Well, a chromosome is 50% DNA, the hereditary material, and 50% protein. You go, what's the protein? We never talk about that. We only talk about the DNA. Well, the issue about it is this. Once science found that the program appeared to be in the DNA, then all research was to isolate the DNA by first opening up the nucleus, collect the chromosomes, separate the protein from the DNA, save the DNA for the experiment, and then throw away the protein. And they did that for 50 years until somebody finally said, you know, 50% of the nucleus is protein. Maybe it's doing something. And so here's what we now know. The DNA forms a core, and the DNA are linear blueprints, the blueprints to make the proteins. That's what they are, blueprints. But surrounded by a sleeve of protein. So, for example, if I hold up my arm and I say, here's the DNA, and if I took a magic marker and wrote the genetic code for blue eyes, and I hold it up, I say, can you read the gene for blue eyes, yes or no? Pretend I had it all written. Yeah. I say, yeah, but what does it look like when it's in the nucleus? Oh, looks like this. A sleeve of protein. Can you read the gene for blue eyes, yes or no? If you want to read the gene for blue eyes, what must you do? Remove the sleeve, the protein. What causes a protein to change shape? There it goes. Here's how it works. A chromosome has a linear strand of DNA inside. At the beginning of each part of the blueprint, there's a special protein called the regulatory protein. Okay? Remember, proteins and environmental signals are complementary like a lock and a key. So a specific signal will activate a specific regulatory protein. So here's how it works. A signal from the environment is sent through the cell, goes into the nucleus, the signal shows up, finds the complementary protein. Yes, signal binds to protein. What is the consequence? Movement. I say, well, what is the movement going to do? Well, what the movement's going to do is, watch, takes the sleeve off. Once the sleeve is off, the gene can be read. So I need to bring up something to read the gene. And so I bring up a special protein that's called a polymerase. And what it's going to do is read the DNA and make a copy called RNA. DNA goes to RNA. This is going to go out into the cell and be used as a blueprint to make the protein. Once I have the blueprint, I don't need the gene. The signal pops off, and we're back to normal again. What was the point? Well, listen, for 50 years, we were so behind the genes controlling everything. We should, you know, for at least 30 seconds, give our, you know, boost to the DNA. So let's, okay, DNA, come on, baby, you do something, DNA. I want you, you know, we trust that you control everything. There you are, do something. Now you're going to do something, right? Are you going to do something? Do anything? What was the point? DNA has no action. All that time you've heard DNA turn on and off. It's like, no, DNA didn't turn on and off. The sleeve came on and off. The sleeve is the protein. When you uncover the gene, you can read the gene. But the uncovery of a gene is based on environmental signal. So it's never the gene made a decision at all. That's a completely false understanding. So I say, okay, some of us in this room, I could see, are old like me. Remember the old days when television wasn't on 24 hours a day and they had something called a test pattern? So I say, what's a test pattern? I say, well, the test pattern is the broadcast. It's a pattern. Oh, DNA is a pattern. So let's make the test pattern represent DNA, okay? I say, why is it relevant? So I say, oh, the test pattern's on the screen. But I say, guess what? There are dials. I can change the dials. And if I change the dials, I can turn it on and off. I can change the volume. I can change the horizontal, the vertical. I can change all those. So here, let me mess with the dials. Whoops. Oh, I changed the pattern. Most important point. Did I change the original broadcast? Yes or no? Yes or no? Oh, why is this relevant? Epigenetics is changing the readout, but doesn't change the original blueprint. And so basically I said, oh, look, I can mess with some more buttons and change the picture again. I can do thousands of variations on this, right? Did I ever touch the pattern information? No. I only adjusted the dials on the television. The same broadcast is there. Here's the most important conclusion. Epigenetics changes the readout, but does not change the gene. You go, well, how can that happen? I go, well, here, strand of DNA. This area, let's mark this one. This is the gene, a blueprint. Let's say the gene for blue eyes. There it is right there. It only accounts the genes for less than 3% of the DNA. If 3% of the DNA is making blueprints for proteins, what the heck is the 97% doing? The answer for a long time was junk DNA. Cells are stupid and inefficient, and for a billion years have been carrying around a bunch of DNA that is no use at all, 97%, and that is like, holy jeez, this is a bunch of BS. That's belief system, okay? I go, why? I say, what is the nature of this? And here's what it is. 3% are genes. 97% do not code for genes. What do they have? Oh, on that 97%, there are protein modules. They're called modules. I say, what do they represent? They represent the dials on the television set. You change the signal to these protein modules, and they change the readout of the gene without changing the blueprint of the gene. Okay? And so the relevance about this is called epigenetics. Signals from the environment change the proteins, which in turn change the reading of the gene. So epigenetics can send signals to regulate the proteins, but epigenetics can also send a signal that adds a methyl group to the DNA. And you say, why should I change the DNA? And here's the answer. You ready? You have two sets of all the genes, one from your mother, one from your father. In almost all cases, with few exceptions, only one gene is read out of the pair. So that means you have to cancel one of the genes. So epigenetic methylation, it's called, binds to one of the pair and inhibits it. So only one of the two genes will function, either the maternal one or the paternal one, okay? It's based on environmental information. So I say, well, how does it work? Now watch. Pretend I make what's called the messenger RNA, the RNA. I say, and the gene is called the reading gene. I say, what can you do by changing the dials? It's the equivalent of scissors and tape. Watch. Epigenetics, what can I do? I can cut off the ing. Now I got the read gene, okay? Oh, I can cut off the RIA. Now I got the ding gene. Wait. I can remove the RE and the ING. Now I got the add gene. And I go, I can do this. Well, what can I do? Is cut out the middle, tape the two back together. I got the ring gene. What's the point? And the point is this. The same blueprint, but I made a copy called RNA, and now I can cut the RNA up and put it back together again. You say, why is it relevant? Epigenetic control, the one gene blueprint, I can create over 3,000 different versions of proteins from the same gene. Relevance. Almost all of us got here with a normal, healthy set of genes to have a completely healthy, happy life on this planet. You say, where the hell did the illness come from? Altering the readout of the gene by the environment and your perception of the environment via epigenetics. You change a healthy gene into a cancer gene. That's why we find that 90% of cancer has no hereditary linkage. 90% of cancer is lifestyle. That's what it comes down to. Changing your belief changes the readout of the gene. So you can actually have a spontaneous remission by changing your perception of the environment and how you respond to it. You can heal yourself from any disease. As a matter of fact, what do we know right now? 90% of cardiovascular disease is environment and lifestyle. 70 to 90% of all cancer is now demonstrated totally to be lifestyle, okay? Even Alzheimer's is lifestyle. And every time you look at all these different things, it's like we keep blaming the gene. It's like, no, almost all of us got here with a good set of genes. What does it mean? Our epigenetic alteration based on the signals coming in have altered the readout of the genes and in most cases made it negative. Okay? So this is what epigenetics is all about. It does not change the genes you came with. It changes the readout of the genes that you have. Okay? So I say, well, what does all this mean? I say, well, first of all, I'm talking about cells in a petri dish, adding the culture medium, and changing the genetic activity of the cell. And I say that, and then all of a sudden you say, yeah, but Bruce, what the hell is that? That's cells in a plastic petri dish? What does it have to do with me? Here is what it has to do with you. When you look in the mirror and see yourself, and you see a single individual looking back at you, and you say, oh, that's a single human, Bruce, I could see it in the mirror. A total misperception. The reason is this. A human is made out of about 50 trillion cells. The cells are the living entity. The human, by definition, is a community of cells. There's no one organism here. There's 50 trillion cells. The cells are the living organism. So why is it relevant? Because while I talk about cells in a plastic petri dish, guess what? You are a skin-covered petri dish. You have 50 trillion cells inside your skin. I say, yeah, and guess what? You have culture medium, the original culture medium. What's the original culture medium? Blood. I say, why is it relevant? Because the experiment demonstrates that the cells respond to the conditions of the blood or the culture medium. It doesn't make a difference if they're in a plastic dish or a skin dish. They still respond to the signals provided by the culture medium. And I say, well, what signals should we worry about? Well, number one, nutrition. Why? When I grew my cells in the laboratory, I did not buy my ingredients at Kmart. I only bought the best. Why? If I compromised on any of the ingredients in the culture medium, and once I fed the cells, I could show you, you could see the cells respond within minutes if the culture medium isn't of good quality. And this is profound. Why? You're making culture medium with your nutrition. And we start buying industrial farm food with all the toxins and the pollution in it, you are actually debilitating yourself. This is an urgency to come back to organic, natural food without all the chemistry from the petroleum industry involved. You're making culture medium, then damn it, start with the best ingredients possible. That's really what it comes down to. Number two, cellular signals are in the blood. Ah, the blood doesn't have just nutrition. The blood has information in it. I go, well, how does it work? Simple. The environment outside of the body and inside the body are two environments, and they have signals. What's going on? It's raining out. It's cold out. Whatever. Okay? I say, well, what reads the signals? I go, oh, the brain. It's perception. I'm reading the signals out there. I walk out the door. It's cold out. Okay, I can feel that. I say, then what happens? The brain, in response to the environmental signals, sends signals via the nervous system and the blood to the cells. I say, yeah, but what do the signals do when they get to the cells? They control behavior. They control gene activity. So the expression of your cells is not inherently controlled from inside. The expression of your cells is controlled from the environment on the outside. And this becomes relevant because you can control that. And so basically what this says is the signals that are carried by the nervous system and the blood via signal transduction, that's science, controls behavior and genetics. Okay? Now I add a very important part, because what we're saying here is environment controls behavior and genes. That is absolutely true. But now here's an issue. I got liver cells in me. They have to adjust their biology to what's going on in the world, because they're helping my complete 50 trillion cell community live in this world. So my liver cells need to know what the heck is going on outside so they can adjust their biology. Does that make sense at this point? And I say, why is it relevant? Because we left something out when it comes to humans, and that is this. The brain does perception, for sure, but guess what? The mind does interpretation. It's the interpretation where the problem comes from. Why? The cells can't read what's going on in the real environment. They can only read what the nervous system is telling them is going on in the real environment. If I have a misperception of the environment, then by definition, I'm sending incorrect information to my cells, which are trying to adjust their biology to what? Misinformation. And as a result, health will fall out of the window at that moment, because you're not living in harmony with the real world, because your interpretation could be totally wrong. I say, you know, look, we walk outside and it's cold out. And I say, well, what's the relevance about that? Well, then what controls your biology at this point? The temperature sensors in your skin pick up that it's cold out. What are they going to do? They're going to change your metabolism. They're going to make you warm up inside, keep the body temperature constant, keep it working right. And I go, great. I say, what if you walk out when it's cold out? We warm up. What if I walk out and it's warm out? Oh, my biology changes again. Now I perspire and change everything. No, not 10 minutes. Okay. Okay. The point is, the control is coming from the mind. The mind is sending signals to the brain to what it should be released. So the idea about this is, well, then the mind is an interpretation. And the bottom line, then, the mind is really your belief. Your belief is controlling behavior and genes, because what you believe is going to send chemistry to complement your belief. That's how it comes down to, okay? So I say, well, look, the brain makes the culture medium. The brain is the chemist. It feeds the 50 trillion cells in your culture dish. So to show you how simple it is, it goes like this. You're here with your eyes closed. boom, you open up your eyes, and guess what? You see someone you love. I said, what's the consequence of interpreting love? Well, you are now becoming what is called a self-biologist. You're making your own biology. I say, how does it work? I said, when you perceive love, the brain releases these elements into the culture medium. Dopamine is pleasure. Yeah, it's fun to be in love. Oxytocin is the chemical that says bond to the one that you have to love from. Okay? Vasopressin makes you more attractive to your partner. And growth hormone does exactly what it says. That's why when people fall in love, they're so healthy. Oh, see how they glow. They're so in love. And I go, it's chemistry. Where did it come from? Interpretation. I go, here's why it's different. Because I said, open your eyes and you see someone you love. But I go, wait. Open your eyes and see something that scares you. Oh, these chemicals are not coming out. You're in fear. The chemicals that are coming out are stress hormones and inflammatory agents. They completely change the biology because you've changed the composition of the culture medium, the blood. And so the composition of the culture medium is a complement to your perception. Are you in a happy, safe environment, a healthy environment? Or are you scared? Are you nervous? Is your life in threat? Why? Totally different chemistry. Totally different chemistry means what? Totally different gene function. The genes are adjusting to your perception at the time. So most of us, that we were young, we played with something called paint by numbers. And I say, how does it work? Well, you start with an image and it's carved up and there are numbers in there. I said, what do the numbers represent? Well, the numbers represent the paints. And so in step two, you match the paint numbers to this thing and you fill them in. And I say, then what results? I say, oh, Picasso. You just did Picasso. I go, really? And I go, here's the simple understanding about life. Paint by numbers in reverse. Paint by numbers. Create by numbers. I say, how does it work? Cool. This is how simple. You start with a picture in your mind. The brain breaks the picture down into numbers. But the numbers are not tints. The numbers are neurochemistry, hormones and growth factors and regulatory agents. And then they're released into the body, and the body then becomes shaped to match the picture. Your mind starts with the picture and turns it into chemistry, which then controls your biology. Change the picture, you've completely changed the biology. And all of a sudden you start to realize you're the one that's controlling all this. It's the picture in your head. Okay? So I say, what's the function of the mind? The function of the mind is simple. Here's what it is. Create coherence between your beliefs and your reality. What does it mean? You have a belief. The chemistry that matches that belief is released into the body to create a biology that is a complement to the belief. You believe you're going to get sick? You can release the chemistry you want to do that. You believe you're going to die? You can release that. And I say, if you believe you're going to heal yourself, you can release that too. That was called the placebo effect. What was placebo? A belief that this medication is the thing that's going to heal me. I say, what was it? It was a sugar pill, but it still healed me. I say, well, then what caused the healing? And the answer was simply this, not the sugar pill. It was the belief in the sugar pill. I say, why is it relevant? Because everyone says, yes, I understand. I know what you're talking about, placebo effect. And I go, no. What I didn't talk about, and it's the most important character, is what about a negative belief? We only talked about the positive belief. What about a negative belief? Equally powerful to a positive belief, but it works in the opposite direction. A placebo can heal you, and it's called a nocebo. A nocebo, a negative belief, can kill you. If you've been diagnosed with the disease and you have been told by an authority figure that you will die in 3 months, you have created a new belief. That belief will release the chemistry and you will die in approximately 3 months. It's the same power as placebo, but it works in the opposite direction. Okay? So we go back 2,500 years, the Buddha. What we think, we become. Absolutely right. It's exactly what it's all about. Okay? I say, well, what's the issue about that? And I go, here's what's the issue. Signal plus protein equals behavior. And why is it important? Because if the behavior is not working right, we refer to it as a dis-ease. It's a dis-ease. My behavior isn't working right. I say, oh, your behavior isn't working right? What can you attribute that to? There's only two things on the other side of the arrow. I just want you to know, if the behavior isn't working right, either the proteins aren't working right or the signal is wrong. That's the only two things. I said, so why is it relevant? I said, well, can the protein be wrong? The answer is yes. If you have genes that are defective, you make a defective protein. I say, well, what's the consequence? Blame genetics. Flawed genes cause less than 1% of disease. I can only attribute disease, less than 1% of disease, to the flawed genes. And I say, well, then, if only 1% of disease is flawed genes, then where the hell's the health crisis coming from? And the answer is, not the genes. It's not here. This is less than 1%. Genetic birth defects, random mutations, less than 1% can cause a disease. That leaves the signal. I go, oh, jeez. Over 90% of disease is the signal. You're sending the wrong signal, inappropriate signal, misinterpreted signal. I go, how does it work? I go, well, you send signals to the cells. I say, well, how can I affect the signal? I say, trauma. You fall down outside, you wrench your back, you mess up the nervous system. But since the nervous system is sending a signal, if you mess up the nervous system, you interfere with the signal. Net result, disease. Number two, toxins. If you put toxins into the system and I'm sending a signal from A to B and there are toxins between A and B, toxins can distort the signal. And that's a cause of disease. And number three, and this is the one, this is the biggest share of everything, thought. Why? There's nothing wrong with the biology. It was the thought that was incorrect. The thought took you out of harmony. The thought related to a release of chemistry that undermined your health rather than helping your health. And all of these represent what? Well, trauma is a physical expression. Toxins are a chemical expression. Thought is an emotional expression of what? And the answer is stress. How much is stress influencing the health in this world? How does stress affect us? American Psychological Association, from 75 to 90% of all physician office visits are for stress-related ailments. The issue is stress. Hell, all you have to do is read the newspaper, watch the TV, and go on that. You'll be stressed continuously. That's why we are sick as a massive population. Everyone is under stress. And it becomes important because this is not an unknown entity. The healthcare crisis in this country is sinking us economically, and yet they already know what the cause is. It's stress, and they're just exacerbating it. I say, so what kind of stresses are there? And the answer is this. There's two kinds of stress, and I want you to recognize the difference. Eustress is good stress. What the hell is good stress? Go out and play some sports. Why is it relevant? You're stressing your body, but what are you causing it to do? Grow stronger, okay? So what's the difference between eustress and good stress versus distress is bad stress? And here's what the difference is. You ready? Distress is anything that gets in the way of your destination. Wherever you want to go in this world, if something is blocking you, that's the source of stress. Okay? So stress is a result of something interfering with your life performance at that point. Let me show you a very important part about this. I put cells in a petri dish. In one set of dishes, I put nutrients in front of the cells. Second set of dishes, I put toxins in front of the cells. I put them back in the incubator, and I come back. You know where the hell the cells are going to be. I don't have to tell you, but I'll show it to you. And that is this. When nutrients in a dish, cells always move toward positive signals. Okay? When toxins are in the dish, cells always move away from negative signals. The point is this. You read the environment, and if it's a growth signal, what do? You move toward it with your arms open to take it in. Assimilation. If it's a threat, what do? You don't move toward it. You move away from it, and you close yourself down. Okay? Point. Can you move forward and backwards at the same time? No. Can you be open and closed at the same time? No. What's the point? You can't be in growth and in protection at the same time. And the more you perceive the need for protection, the more you shut down growth. And I say, how does it work? And it goes like this. It's called the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, HPA. What does it mean? Hypothalamus is the portion of the brain that interprets the signal. Good signal, bad signal. Hypothalamus will tell you which one it is. If it's a threat signal, then the hypothalamus sends a signal to the pituitary gland. Remember the name in high school? Master gland. The signal from the brain is now telling the master gland to coordinate 50 trillion cells to respond to this environment. How does it do it? The pituitary gland sends signals to the adrenal glands. And the adrenal glands, fight or flight, right, releases the adrenal hormones through the system. I said, well, how does this affect us? You ready? When you're in fight or flight, what part of your body are you going to use to protect yourself? Pancreas? Thyroid? What part of your body? Come on, somebody answer me so I can go to the next thing. Arms and legs! Point. If you're going to depend on your arms and legs for function, you have to give it blood because blood has all the energy in it. So guess what? The moment you see something that stresses you, the body responds, and here's right out of the textbook. You ready? The body responds by preferentially sending the blood to the arms and legs. Does that make sense? Yeah, but nobody questioned me. Where the hell was the blood if it was preferentially somewhere else before? And the answer was this. It was in your gut. I say, what's the function? The viscera, growth, maintenance, taking care of the body. Arms and legs, protection. Point. The moment stress hormones come into the system, they cause the blood vessels in the gut to squeeze shut. It's called butterflies in the stomach. That's what you can feel. The butterflies are the gut blood vessels squeezing shut. And I say, yeah, why? What happens? If you squeeze the blood vessels shut, it forces the blood to the periphery, arms and legs. I'm going to go fast right now. Okay. I'm finished in 1 minute. 2 minutes. Okay. Here's the point. The point is this. The blood vessels in the gut shut down when you're in stress. I say, why is it relevant? Since blood is the energy nourishment, then the function of the viscera are shut down when you're in stress. You stop maintaining the body. You stop growing and taking care of it. The point is this, you lost the function of maintenance. And I say, what else happens? You ready? Because the idea is this, you have to grow every day. Why do you have to grow? You're an adult. Why do you have to grow every day? You ready? You lose hundreds of billions of cells every day. Natural attrition. Naturally, hundreds of billions of cells die every day. Blood cells are dying. Skin cells are dying. Look, my hair cells have died. I haven't replaced them yet, but I'm working on it. Here's the point. And the point is this. Everybody must grow every day because how many days in a row can you go if you're losing hundreds of billions of cells every day and not replacing them? Not too long. Okay? That's the first problem. That's the first problem causing of illness. Second problem is this. There are two protection systems. The fight or flight. For threats on the outside, what protection is on the inside? Immune system. Does the immune system use energy? If you've ever been sick, you know damn well it does. You don't have enough energy to get out of bed. And I say, well, why is it relevant? I'll give you a simple point here. You're in charge of energy production in the system, where it's going to go. You have a little office up here in the brain. You go to work Monday morning, phone rings. It says, oh, my God, we're having a bacterial infection in the gut. We might be really getting ready for a case of bad diarrhea. How much energy can you send us to fight the bacteria? You put the phone down. You're doing a calculation. The phone rings again. Much more excited voice. Holy crap, we're being chased by a saber-toothed tiger. How much energy can you send me? You're in charge of energy. How much energy do you want to send to fight the bacteria? And what percent of would you send to fight, you know, to run away from the tiger? Got an answer? 100% to run away from the tiger. Why? If the tiger catches you, the bacteria is no longer a problem. Okay? Why is this relevant? And the answer is very clearly this. Stress hormones not only close the blood vessels in the gut, forcing the blood to the periphery, but stress hormones shut down the immune system. So effective that doctors use it therapeutically. When? When they're transplanting an organ into somebody and they don't want the immune system to rapidly reject the foreign tissue, they give the patient stress hormones before the transplant. Shuts down the immune system. I say, why is it relevant? And the answer was this. The stress system was designed 1 million years ago to run away from a saber-toothed tiger. You run away, you're safe. You know, you have to use it for 10 minutes. You're full out stress. But after that 10 minutes, you're safe. And everything goes back to normal. Today's world is 24/7, 365 stress. We were never designed to be under chronic stress. Chronic stress is shutting down the entire system, okay? And one last one. Okay. Remember Pac-Man? Well, here's why it's important. When the player P, is designed to go catch as many dots as they can and avoid the G, the gobbler, that's going to kill them. When the goblin is far enough away from the player can think, what am I going to do? I'm going to move this way and I'm going to go this way. So I'm thinking. I say, look at a brain scan. Forebrain, conscious reasoning and processing. So when the goblin is far away, the player is thinking. I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, and I'm thinking a lot. But if the gobbler gets within 2 centimeters of the player, now look at the brain scan. The blood's in the hindbrain. Reflex, reactive behavior. No more thinking. What's the point? When you're under stress, you're less intelligent. And we've been put under stress. And British parliamentarian Tony Benn, in the movie Sicko, Michael Moore's movie, there was an interview with Tony Benn, parliamentarian. What did he say? Governments do not want a healthy, intelligent population because they are difficult to control. And I look at America since the time I was a kid over 70 years ago and look at it today, and I can say they succeeded. We are now the sickest and perhaps some of the dumbest people on the planet. But it's an intention. It's an intention because you've been disempowered. You are unhealthy, and you are now in a chronic stress mode, okay? She says that's enough. That is enough.
It's never enough. It's never enough. The issue is that they're going to shut down the podcast, and we won't be able to finish.
Okay.
So in taking a reading of the audience, being so enraptured by what you were saying, questions went sideways, folks.
I got to answer
the book
some
is
questions.
Going to be sold. The book will be sold outside. I'm going to close the program, and then Bruce will be here for questions and signing.
Okay? Questions.
As soon as I close the
program. Close the program. I'm sitting over here.
The rest of us could sleep over because I could listen to you for days. I am Adria Breyer, a member of the Health and Medicine member-led forum of the Commonwealth Club. Books are for sale and signing outside. Our thanks to Dr. Bruce Lipton forever for your discoveries and your comments today. We thank our audiences here as well as our listening audiences for the recording. And now this meeting, which is not going to happen, we're not adjourning, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, officially commemorating 114 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned for this part of the program.
All right.
We have questions.
We have questions. We don't know if we have answers, but we have questions. Question.
My father has schizophrenia. My maternal grandmother is bipolar. My aunt has suicidal depression. My mother has high anxiety, and so do my sisters. That's quite a petri dish. Maybe I can control my environment so I don't trigger any mental illness, but isn't this like a bomb ready to go off? Even if I do my best to control my environment, doesn't my genetic lottery mean I have to spend more time and effort trying to recreate these signals? How do I do it?
Okay, number one is to recognize this, that the signals come from the mind. But now I have to, there's two parts to the mind. There's the conscious part and the subconscious part. This is profoundly different. The conscious part is connected to your unique identity, your spirituality, your individuality. It's the conscious brain, primarily the prefrontal cortex right behind your forehead. That's creative. The subconscious is not a creative mind. The subconscious is a habit mind. It has habits built into it. And the relevance about that is it is not creative. It's just a stimulus response. The point about it is this. You need the subconscious mind to get the programs to carry out life. How do you become a member of a family and a community? And the answer is in the first 7 years of your life, your subconscious mind is on hypnosis. It's in theta. The brain state theta, which is imagination, which characterizes kids between especially 2 and 7 that can live in the real world and the imaginary world simultaneously. That's a state of theta. Theta is also hypnosis. The relevance is, if you think how many rules must a human learn to be a member of a family and a community? Thousands. How are you going to teach an infant that? Give him a book? No. Nature takes care of it. What does it do? It puts the brain in hypnosis for 7 years. 7 years, the child observes the mother, the father, the family, and the community, downloading other people's behavior. The point about it is this. The subconscious programs, the basic programs of the subconscious, do not come from you, has nothing to do with your wishes, your desires, or anything you want. They were downloaded from other people. Once you're seven, you start to engage the conscious mind, and you can work with the programs at that point. The fact is, since you didn't even know you got programmed and you don't know you have programs, that's the invisible part that really screws everybody up. And for the simple reason is this. I have two parts of the mind. Conscious is me, unique, identity, creative, and subconscious is just habituation. Okay? And I say, why is it relevant? And the answer comes down to simply this. The conscious mind is creative and can create anything you want out of this life. But the problem is this. The conscious mind can also think. And I say, well, what does that mean? I say, when you're thinking, you go inside. As I gave to you earlier tonight, I say, I ask you a question. I say, seriously, stop for a second and tell me what you're doing at Sunday at 2 o'clock. The reason why I'm asking you that is when you process this information, where the hell is the answer? It's not out here. Where's the answer? It's inside. Conscious mind in thinking lets go of the control and goes inside. But it doesn't mean if you're walking down the street and you have a thought, okay, I got it, okay, now I can go again. It means this. The moment you're in thought, the default is the subconscious because it takes over. Subconscious knows how to walk, talk, do everything you do. It's habit. So the idea is this. Science has recognized, and this is the most critical thing I can tell you at this moment. You're only conscious, controlling your life with your wishes and desires 5% of the day. 95% of the day you're in thought. 95% of the day you automatically default to the subconscious programs. The subconscious programs are not yours. They came from other people. Psychologists will tell you 70% or more of those programs are actually disempowering, limiting, and self-sabotaging. I say, why is it relevant? Because only 5% of the day are you moving toward your destination. 95% of the day you're playing these programs, most of them negative. And you say, well, I would be aware if I was doing that. Then I give the story, as I've given in every lecture forever. You probably had a friend, knew your friend's behavior very well, and knew your friend's parent. And one day saw that your friend has the same behavior as their parent, which excites you, because you can't wait to tell your friend. Hey, Bill, you're just like your dad. Back away from Bill. Bill's the first one to go totally ballistic and say, how the hell can you compare me to my dad? Almost everybody's seen that and experienced that. I say, this is the most profound story at this minute I can tell you, for the reason is this. Everyone else can see that Bill behaves like his dad. The only one who doesn't see it is Bill. Explain it simple. He got the program in the first 7 years observing his father. But 95% of the day when he's in thought, he's playing that program. But because he's in thought, he doesn't see the program. So he's the one that denies that. How can you compare me to my father? And he totally is. We are all like that. And the point is that is we are all Bill. There's nobody in this room that didn't have programming in the first 7 years. And that programming is so vital because it controls your life because it's 95% of your life. And I go, is this a new thing of science? I go, maybe in science, but the Jesuits for 400 years have said, give me a child until it's seven and I will show you the man. Didn't understand what the hell they were saying, did you? They were saying, if you give me the opportunity to educate the child for 7 years, I will show you what the outcome is going to be of that child. Why? Because they will represent the program. You're all representing the program. The problem is this, the programs are invisible. Why? Because when you're playing them, your conscious mind's not observing. But every now and then it does, doesn't it? Every now and then you catch yourself and go, oh, geez, I was just like my mother. Oh, God, that was... But that's rare. Because most of the time you don't see it. And since 70% or so of those programs, according to psychologists, are negative and disempowering, self-sabotaging, then recognize why your life doesn't work so easily. Why? Because you're not operating from your conscious wishes and desires. So the movie The Matrix... is a documentary. Everybody got programmed. And then I'm going to say, what's the beautiful part about it? Because in the movie, they talk about, you can take the red pill and get out of the program. I said, well, what happens when you take the red pill? Well, I'm going to tell you, you already know. Almost everybody in this room has already taken the red pill at one time, at least. I say, when was that? When you fell in love. Science has found that when you fall in love, initially fall in love, guess what? You stay mindful. You keep your conscious mind present. And you operate from conscious mind, which is what? Wishes and desires. That's called the honeymoon. The honeymoon is no matter how your life sucked, boom, you meet this person. Then the next day, it's, hey, it's heaven on earth. Man, I love this place. It's really great. I go, what the hell happened? And the answer was this. The moment you fell in love was the first time you didn't default to the subconscious program. That's science now. We recognize that. Why is it relevant? Because from this point on, now you're operating from conscious creativity, which is wishes and desires. And when two people together are working from wishes and desires at the same time, what the hell do you think they manifest? Heaven on earth. And that's the issue. And the issue is this. You've already touched it once. You've had some experience, but you didn't understand. And then you lose that honeymoon. You go, why the hell did I lose the honeymoon? And the answer is, because inevitably, you're still involved with life. You still have a job. You have chores to do. You've got things to take care of. I say, why is it relevant? Because you start thinking. Oh, the moment you start thinking, the behavior that's coming out is not coming from your conscious mind. Where's it coming from? Subconscious. Where'd that come from? Parents and family and community. And I say, why is it relevant? I'm in love. I'm in honeymoon with my wife, Margaret. She comes up. She asks me some loving question. But at this moment, I'm thinking about fixing a car. And she comes up, asks me some loving question. Blah, blah, blah. She looks at me. Who are you? Where did that come from? We got a problem. You know why? It came from my programming, but I didn't see it. And now I've been accused of not being myself, and now marital conflict. Why? What kind of behavior the hell is that? And I said, I don't even know what you're talking about. I'm not that person. Not in my conscious mind. My subconscious. Okay? That's when the honeymoon starts coming to an end, when all these behaviors start showing up that were never part of the honeymoon, and compromises must occur. And there are so many compromises, and there's a reach a point where there's too many compromises, relationship's over with. And you don't understand, what the hell happened? It started out so beautifully, and it ended so crazy. And the reason is that. I'm sorry I extended that question way too long.
Wish I could have recorded that. What about Ebola and dengue fever? Are they also thoughts causing disease?
Okay. Are we affected by everything that we live in the environment? Oh, you can say so. You know, like, how about drinking strychnine poison? You think that might be pretty toxic, right? Well, here's the point. People down in the South work themselves up into a religious ecstasy. These are fundamentalists, work themselves up into ecstasy. They start speaking tongues and stuff like that. But they do something called testifying. What the hell is testify? You do something so absurdly crazy that no normal person in their right mind would ever think of, how could you do that? And the reason they do it is because they have the firm belief that God protects them. Not whether it's God or not, this is a firm belief. They're protected. I say, what do? Many of them are snake handlers. They play with all these poisonous vipers. They get bitten. One died actually about a month ago, but most of them have no adverse effect. And you go, oh, that's pretty cool. And they go, no, no. Here's the one I want you to understand. Some of them testify by drinking strychnine in toxic doses and have no adverse effects. What's the point? You could drink strychnine poison and not have any adverse effects. But you better damn well believe that. You can't be 99% in belief. You need 100% on this one, okay? It's the exact same thing about walking across hot coals. You can walk across the hot coals as long as you believe you can walk across the hot coals. But the moment you have doubt in the middle of that walk is the moment you will get burned. So the idea is, are you frail and vulnerable? The answer is only in your mind. Because if you get your mind right, you are powerful people. You're all powerful people. But we have been programmed to believe we are frail. We have been programmed to lose our power. And I say, why would they have done that? And the answer is very simple. Where do you think all the powerful people come from on this planet? Like they got more power than it? Where the hell did you get all that power from? They didn't get any more power than you. They took away your power so that you are powerless and they still retain the power. You've heard of rich dad, poor dad. That's the same story again. You grow up with a belief system in a rich family and you could be a stupid idiot and still stay rich. I'm not going to make any political comment. But the simple point was, but poor people grow up with a belief system of being poor. No matter how hard they try, they stay poor. It's because the program, and we've all been programmed, that you couldn't get here without a program. You had to have that program, okay? But once people knew that they can empower themselves by disempowering you, the game switched, and now we are the powerless, at least in our belief system.
What is the most effective way of reprogramming ourselves and seeing the third burden going backwards?
The which one going backwards?
When you had the three birds.
Oh.
Right? And you said the one that was being painted.
Yeah.
Right?
Paint by numbers.
Okay, yeah.
What's the most effective way to see the third one as the way we view life?
Okay, let me tell you, here's what the issue is. We have been programmed to believe in something called the mind. That's been the biggest problem because they're actually two separate minds with two separate functions and they learn in different ways. And that is the problem. They don't learn the same. The conscious mind is the creative mind. I say, well, how does a creative mind learn? Go to the lecture, read the self-help book, watch a video, even just go, aha, the conscious mind has changed. I go, subconscious mind does not learn that way. And there's nobody in the subconscious mind. That's the other bigger problem. Why? Because how much time do we spend talking to ourselves to change the belief? I don't want this behavior anymore. I hate this behavior. I don't like this behavior. Don't do this anymore. I go, who are you talking to? I'm talking to my subconscious. I go, problem. There's nobody in the subconscious. You are in the conscious mind. The subconscious mind is a record playback device. You can talk to it until you're blue in the face. That's not how it learns. I say, so how does the subconscious learn? Because you want to write it, you got to know how it learns. Number one, first 7 years is hypnosis. You get into theta. I say, well, how can you do that? You say, you have to see a hypnotherapist? I say, no. Every night as you go to bed, your vibrations of your brain from the working day, beta, high vibration, you get home at night, you slow the vibration down, it's called alpha, that's called calm consciousness. And just as consciousness separates and you fall into sleep, you jump into theta. Theta is the immediate next lower step on the ladder, but theta is hypnosis. So every night, you go through hypnosis. So every night, if you put earphones on with a program, as your conscious mind checks out, the program is playing directly into the subconscious, hypnosis, auto-hypnosis. That's one way. Number two, how do you learn after seven? Hypnosis is not the way. After seven is repetition. Anything you wanted to learn, you had to repeat. How many times did you say A, B, C until you could get to Z? Once you got to Z, though, you never had to repeat it again. Once you learned how to walk, you didn't have to learn how to do it again. So the subconscious mind is not evil. Some of the programs might be bad, but the mind itself is one of the most powerful things you have in your service. You don't have to relearn how to walk every day. It's 2 years old. You already did it. It's done. Okay? So I say, well, how do you do this after seven? Repetition. Whatever it is, practice. You have to repeat it over and over again. And it's not something in your life, but you still have to repeat it until what? The subconscious mind learns the program you want. And I say, why is that important? What's the function of the mind? Take the belief and make it coherent with your life. You change the belief of who you are, the mind changes the biology and the behavior to conform to that new belief, okay? But you have to put it in by repetition. That's two ways. The third way is something new, and it's the most fabulous and necessary thing on this planet because necessity is the mother of invention. We have a necessity to change our behavior, not over a long period of time. We need to change our behavior fast these days because human behavior is causing the sixth mass extinction that you are in right now. If you didn't know it, the environment is collapsing all around you. We are in a state of mass extinction. And it's based on human behavior. So if we want to get out of mass extinction, we have to behave differently because it's us that's causing the problem. So Mother of Invention says, is there a fast way to do it? And the answer is yes. There are new modalities called energy psychology. They engage what is called superlearning. And superlearning, you may have seen somebody engage in superlearning work. You ever see anybody in a bookstore read a book by just turning the page and moving the finger down? As fast as they move the finger is how fast they read that page. They can read a whole book in a few minutes just going like that. That's superlearning. If you engage that superlearning process and use it to download a new belief, somewhere between 5 and 10 minutes, you can rewrite any belief you've had in your entire life, in your whole life. You can rewrite it in 5 to 10 minutes. But you have to engage the superlearning process to do it. Otherwise, it's no effect at all.
Didn't you offer a workshop in
that? I didn't do the workshop, but the one that I like the most because it's the simplest, and I love simplicity, is called PsychK, PSYCH-K.com. Go to that website. You can change a belief you had your whole life in minutes. 5-7 minutes, you can rewrite a belief that's been hobbling you your entire life.
I actually did that weekend with you. We have got to give the room back. You are glorious, and I hope you'll come back.
Thank you so very much.
Awesome. Thank you. Awesome.
Thank you.